The Jerry Bader Show.
AM 1360 97.5 WTAQ News Talk Sports. I don't know if I've ever told this story on the air before or not. I think I have. I must have. How I always remember, although I didn't mention it yesterday, how I always remember the anniversary of the conviction of those accused of killing Tom Monfils in the paper mill back in 1992. It was 1995, October 28th, that he was convicted. Do you know the story, Jason? Do you know how I remember that? And I will always remember that. I wasn't even living in Green Bay at the time. I was doing news in Sheboygan, but obviously the Monfils trial and subsequent murder was big. Big news all over the state. I was living in Sheboygan. And Sheboygan then and still does, so does Fond du Lac. I'm not sure about Oshkosh. But I know Fond du Lac and Sheboygan are halfway, but phone's already ringing. He's like, what? What? Ringing off the hook? No, they went away. Jason's like, what? I don't want to answer calls yet. What's going on here? I'm not even in my chair straight yet. Fond du Lac and Sheboygan get both Milwaukee and Green Bay TV. In Sheboygan, at least the people I knew tended to relate more to Milwaukee, although all the Green Bay TV stations were on the cable system there. The reading of the Monfils verdict was carried by all the TVs. It came just after 6:30, what would have been their 6 o'clock newscast on that, and I remember it was a Saturday. It was Saturday, about 6:40. How can you remember this? Because my wife was in labor. Yesterday is my daughter's 18th birthday. And I always, and people always misconstrue the story. We didn't wait for the verdict to come in to go to the hospital. That was not the case. She was, her contractions were X, whatever, I don't remember now. How far apart they were, and the hospital said, well, don't come in till whatever, whatever, whatever. And it was shortly after the verdict was read that the hospital said, yeah, okay, you can come in. It just fell that way. So we actually did see the reading of the verdicts of the accused of the Monfils. And that was, like I said, somewhere between 6:30 and 7 o'clock on a Saturday night. And my daughter was born at 8:48. Once we got to the hospital, she did not mess around. So I always do remember this. I run afoul of a lot of people listen to this show. I do not believe that the Monfils 6 are innocent. I do not believe that. I have never seen any proof, and yes, I have read most of the book that tries to exonerate them. I found nothing in that book convincing, even in the slightest. Because people have asked me over the years why I don't take up this cause, because I don't believe in it. I believe they killed Tom Monfils. But there was an annual event yesterday. As Paul Sarubis writes it in the paper, supporters of the men convicted of Tom Monfils' murder in 1992 may have been chilled by a 29-degree wind chill Monday night, but they have to be warmed by the news that a Minneapolis law firm has gotten involved in the case. About 45 supporters showed up to hold signs in March at the fourth annual Walk for Truth and Justice for Six Innocent Men rally outside the Brown County Courthouse. Dennis Gullickson, co-author of The Monfils Conspiracy, which claims to spell out flaws. I thought the book was a joke. I didn't think it proved anything. To spell out flaws in the investigation and prosecution of the case, served as master of ceremonies for the event. Gullickson told the group that the Minnesota Innocence Project and a major Minneapolis law firm, Frederickson and Byron, are working on the case without cost. The legal team will make an intensive effort to re-examine and reinvestigate the case and to present it when ready to in court, Gullickson said as the crowd cheered. I will be very curious to see what they come up with. These innocent projects have used DNA and other evidence over the years to free innocent people wrongly accused. Some of those go on to commit heinous crimes. But that has happened. It will be very interesting to see what they come up with. Because the book did not convince me in the least. And anyone who believes it was suicide, I think, is just whatever. But we'll see. But for those of you who wonder why I don't get on board with that, because I don't believe they're innocent. I don't. I do not believe that there was a miscarriage of justice there, so I can't get on board with something in which I do not believe. And I don't believe they're innocent. Something happened in Texas yesterday that you should be aware of. It involves an abortion law, at least one element of it. In fact, it's the abortion law that made Wendy Davis famous. It's the law that turned her into Abortion Barbie. At least an element of it. A federal judge yesterday blocked part of a Texas abortion law that gained national attention this summer after a lengthy filibuster by Democratic State Senator Wendy Davis, who is now running for governor, and indications are she's going to get her butt kicked. By the way, did you hear who her campaign manager is? This is unrelated to the story I'm about to share. Her campaign manager is Tammy Baldwin's campaign manager. Going to be interesting to see. U.S. District Judge Lee Yackel of Austin struck down a requirement that doctors who perform abortions obtain admitting privileges at a nearby hospital, concluding that admitting privileges have no rational relationship to improved patient care. That admitting privileges have no rational relationship to improved patient care. This is notable because Wisconsin is among states that recently passed such a law. It, too, was one provision of an abortion law with several elements in it. I have believed for some time that the Wisconsin law, that element of it wasn't going to stand. Of course, it has been challenged. Challenges to admitting privileges requirements have been filed in Alabama, Mississippi, North Dakota, as well as Wisconsin. The argument for them is that oftentimes there have been cases of women who are injured or have serious complications after abortions, and the doctors do nothing. And I'm not talking Kermit Gosnell here. That's the default that liberals go to on this. Well, not everyone's Kermit Gosnell. I'm not talking about Kermit Gosnell. There have been instances where doctors literally wash their hands of the abortion once it's done, and whatever happens to the woman, she's on her own. The argument here is that admitting privileges, that there's a hospital where the doctor is admitted, you know, does have admitting privileges so the patient can be admitted, is if something goes wrong, you know that the doctor who performed the abortion can treat her at a hospital. The argument against it is it's basically a poison pill to try to ban abortions in many states because, especially in rural areas, the 30-mile limit, it just doesn't work. Doctors can't get admitted. I am dubious of how difficult it is to get admitted. They say the problem is because they wouldn't have to beat their, in a lot of hospitals, once to get admitting privileges, they actually have to use those privileges a minimum amount of times. And abortion doctors would not have a tendency to meet that requirement. I don't have a problem with this, but as I've said, my current position on strategy, and don't get confused on this, strategy, not belief system. My belief system hasn't changed. Abortion is murder. My strategy is right now there is a winning abortion policy in America that cuts across the pro-life, pro-abortion lines, and that is the 20-week cutoff. And Wisconsin is looking at such legislation, but it would include other things than the 20-week cutoff. The Texas law grew directly out of the Kermit-Gosnell case, the 20-week law, but it included these other provisions. I would argue states would do well to pass the 20-week limit law, that no abortions after 20 weeks. Why? Because the one thing the Gosnell case did do is create a lot of national popularity for that. And that it was mentioned ad nauseum that most of Europe has first trimester, 12 weeks. And that already American law, even if you limit it to 20 weeks, would be much more limiting. I just got into an email debate with one of the brighter liberals who listens to this show, very smart guy, and very intellectually honest. And we've had a lot of good email debates. Even he tried to dance around this, and I pinned him to the wall on it. What is the difference between what Kermit Gosnell did, killing a live baby on the table, versus killing a baby the same age in the womb? The answer is none. It's why Nancy Pelosi looks like a sputtering fool. It's why Wendy Davis looks like a sputtering fool. And if someone actually asks Mary Burke that, because it's likely such legislation will be in the headlines during the gubernatorial debate, if somebody actually asks her that, she'll look like a sputtering fool because she's looked like that with almost every question she's been asked. So my position on this is narrow it to that 20 weeks. And for those of you who would say, well, what? You mean then other murders of unborn babies are okay? No. This is the mistake both sides are making. I'm not saying compromise. I'm saying get what you can get right now and then continue the fight. But to suggest that we have to get it all at once as conservatives on the abortion issue has left us getting nothing for the last 40 years. And I think, quite frankly, a lot of reasonable people on the other side have thought, yeah, you know, this is nuts. Kermit Gosnell's crime wasn't that he ran a shop of horrors, you know, and that it was a mess and there was blood and filth and all of that. Well, of course, that was his crimes. But the real crime was that he killed live babies. But if he had done it in utero, he wouldn't have been charged with murder. They have figured that out. Liberals have figured out that the public has figured that out. That's why they go nuts when you ask them this question. So I don't have a problem with the admitting provision of this other than if Wisconsin Republicans do take up the 20-week provision, I think it should stand alone. I don't think it should be tied to anything else. Brett Stevens has a piece in today's Wall Street Journal. He calls it the unbearable lightness of Obama. What he's talking about is the excuse that the president's excuse is, well, I didn't know. Well, I didn't know. This is a morphing from the policy that he used to get elected. The policy that he used to get elected, I refer to as the keep his jersey clean policy, where he wouldn't touch a hot issue. He wouldn't go on to the muddy field. He just wouldn't do that. That's what cost John McCain probably the campaign when he rushed in to try to solve the financial crisis and Obama stayed away. I said it that day. I said he just lost the election and a woman criticized me for saying that. Sorry. Standing by that one. Yeah, I think I'm going to not retract that one, Jason. I'm going to hang with that one. This has morphed into, oh, I didn't know. It's gone from I'm not touching that to I didn't know. The most recent one is that we're spying on our friends, Angela Merkel and others. And by the way, when people wonder, the German chancellor's name is pronounced Angela Merkel. It's not Angela Merkel. It's Angela Merkel. So I pronounce it the correct way. It's Angela Merkel. Her cell phone and spying on France and our other friends. Brett Stevens notices a trend here. he has a bunch of stories about the president that he's been collecting. Here's the first. President Obama went nearly 5 years without knowing his own spies were bugging the phones of world leaders. Officials said the NSA has so many eavesdropping operations underway, it wouldn't have been practical to brief him on all of them. Really? Even the Chancellor of Germany and the President of France? All right. Healthcare.gov, the next one. Healthcare.gov is the highest profile experiment yet in the Obama administration's efforts to modernize government by using technology, with the site intended to become a user-friendly pathway to new health insurance options for millions of Americans. This was the president's signature project, and no one with the right technology experience was in charge, said Bob Coker, former White House aide who helped draft the law. Next, tensions between the U.S. and Saudi Arabia have grown sharply in recent months. President Obama authorized the CIA to provide limited arms to carefully vetted Syrian rebels, but it took months for the program to commence. The Saudis were told they never got that information. Besides the Syrian government's gains, there were mounting evidence that Mr. Assad's troops had repeatedly used chemical weapons against civilians. Even as the debate about arming the rebels took on a new urgency, Mr. Obama rarely voiced strong opinions during senior staff meetings. But current and former officials said his body language was telling. He was often impatient and disengaged. He would either scroll through messages on his BlackBerry, he still uses a BlackBerry, or slouching and chewing gum. On Saturdays, the shutdown drama played out on Capitol Hill. President Obama played golf. And it goes on and on. And then he includes this. The essence of Eisenhower's hidden hand, of course, is that there was real work going on that people didn't know at the time. If that's true now, then Obama really is emulating Ike. If, on the other hand, he's simply doing nothing or very little, that would be passivity, not hidden hand leadership. At the time, Ike was accused of being this absentee president, and his defenders say, no, he worked things behind the scenes, the hidden hand. There's indication that Obama's hands off, and the country is rudderless right now. That's what these string of stories are supposed to prove. And he ends with this. Call Mr. Obama's style indifferent, aloof, or irresponsible. But a president who governs like this, reaps the whirlwind. If not for himself, then for his country. Remember, you get to keep your plan. Later in the show, we're going to spend a lot of time on that. It's 8:56.
Listen up, ladies. Right now, bear